This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 2007 was a historic year for American politics. It was the lead-up to the 2008 elections where the first black president would be elected. Bill Adair was Washington bureau chief for the St. Petersburg Times at the time, and he was frustrated. The amount of spin and outright lying coming out of the campaign sent him reeling. But he had an idea, and he called it PolitiFact. The simple premise is this. It's one that could, in fact, has taken hold and spread across the whole country, that reporters and editors would fact-check statements made by politicians and others. The results get assigned a truthometer ranking, anywhere from absolutely true to pants on fire. Now, PolitiFact is a staple of political coverage. The media reports on its results. Politicians use it all the time. And Adair's legacy is secure. But he has since left the paper, which was renamed the Tampa Bay Times. And in fact, he's come to North Carolina to teach at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. He's a professor of computational journalism and has plans for shaping the future of that profession. And he joins us now. Bill Adair, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back to 2007 and coming up with PolitiFact. What was behind that?
Well, my own guilt as a reporter that I was feeling guilty that I had not done enough fact-checking in my coverage of the White House. And I felt like this was something, as the new media era was taking hold, that journalists needed to do. There was too much on the one hand, on the other hand, journalism. And so I went to my editors and proposed the idea, and they fortunately accepted it very quickly. And we got started in the summer of 2007, and it's really wonderful the way it's grown. You mentioned it's spread around the country. It's now in 10 states, so we have PolitiFact Wisconsin, PolitiFact Ohio, PolitiFact Virginia, where we fact-check the governors, state legislators, members of the congressional delegation. It's my feeling that everybody should face the truth-o-meter.
Well, and we're going to get to the most recent, of course, because the lie of the year is President Barack Obama saying that if you want to keep your health care plan under Obamacare, you can keep it. Let's listen.
If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan, period.
All right, that was named the lie of the year. Tell us about it.
So this is something that PolitiFact does every year. Chooses the most significant falsehood of the year. And this is one where there really was no significant debate that this was the most significant falsehood. A poll of PolitiFact readers asking what was their choice, 59% picked this. Nothing else even came close. And this was one that Obama had repeated many, many times. And that, there's no dispute from the White House that this was a falsehood. Even Obama himself acknowledged he was wrong and has apologized for saying it. So this was very clearly the lie of the year.
Well, interestingly enough, this is one where, you know, the people on the ground kind of know that it's not true. It's a lie. I mean, I can't keep it. And so therefore what you said isn't true. Let's go back to the 2012 election now, because that was another tumultuous year. PolitiFact named a Mitt Romney ad as its top lie for 2012. Let's listen.
Who will do more for the auto industry? Not Barack Obama. Fact checkers confirm his attacks on Mitt Romney are false. The truth? Mitt Romney has a plan to help the auto industry. He's supported by Lee Iacocca and the Detroit News. Obama took GM and Chrysler into bankruptcy and sold Chrysler to Italians who are going to build Jeeps in China.
All right, now that was your lie of the year last year. A little harder to fact check on my own. I don't have personal experience with that, right?
Now, that was an artful one because technically when you listen to the statement, the lie of the year last year was that Romney's claim that Obama sold Chrysler to Italians who are going to build Jeeps in China. And the implication clearly was they're going to stop building them in the U.S. and move the production overseas to China. So that was what PolitiFact fact-checked. But if you sort of boil this ad down to individual sentences, the sentences are true. It is the clear message of the ad that was false. And I think one thing that PolitiFact does well is we can get past just the very narrow wording to what is the clear message that people are getting.
And what's exquisite about that ad is they use PolitiFact to say that Barack Obama was lying.
Yes. And this is something I think is very rewarding about what's happened. Fact-checking has become so established now in the political discourse that both sides refer to it, sometimes accurately, sometimes not. We have found occasionally that candidates will refer to a PolitiFact claim wrongly, and then we'll turn around and give them a false or a pants on fire. The most famous episode, Michelle Bachmann, who's has one of the more famous records on PolitiFact, claimed in a debate that PolitiFact had rated everything she said in the last debate to be true, but she was wrong. She had gotten a pants on fire, so we gave her another pants on fire.
You have to have quite a wardrobe to keep up with the number of lies. But you know, you talked about this in 2007, your guilt, your sense that we need to do some fact checking, the paper greed. I mean, what were we doing up until then? Are not newspapers and journalists checking facts?
They were to some extent. I think that there was a movement in the early 90s to do fact checking of campaign ads, but it had kind of petered out. It had become, on the one hand, on the other hand, journalism. And so what PolitiFact did was say very clearly that statement is false or that statement is pants on fire, and did it in an engaging and very webby way. PolitiFact's definitely a new form of journalism, and I think it was needed. And now you can look around the country and around the world. There are fact checkers all over, from Sweden, Norway, Germany, Chile, Australia. PolitiFact actually had a franchise in Australia that did the national election in the summer. So things have changed. And I think it's because the media has changed. It used to be that people would get their messages through filtered sources like newspapers and television broadcasts. But now there are no filters. The campaigns and the politicians can go directly to the people with things that are often misleading. And so I think the fact checkers need to step up and say what's true and what's not.
And the campaigns themselves, and I mean ongoing campaigns, not just the political campaigns, but even while you're in office, have become much more sophisticated, haven't they? They're not waiting around for newspapers to pick up their story.
Oh, it's amazing. And they are they're using social media in incredibly smart ways. They're targeting their base. They're targeting the persuadables, the middle voters that can really determine an issue or an election.
What do you make of the lots of studies that show that when presented with facts, people who have very strong political leanings, partisan leanings, simply ignore the facts and are looking for those facts that validate their position?
Yeah, and I find that discouraging, but I think that's the reality. I think I liken it to being a fan of a sports team. If you are just a diehard Boston Red Sox fan, you're pretty sure that the ump is out to get your team and is going to call out the Red Sox at the plate. And I think the same thing is true in politics. I think the really strong partisans typically can't, not always, but often will resist a fact check. I'm encouraged by some of the work. There's some work being done by Brendan Nyhan, who actually got his PhD at Duke. He and some other researchers have been looking at ways that fact checkers present their information to help us find the best way to present information that corrects misunderstandings, that corrects when somebody has the wrong belief about an issue. And I think that's the kind of thing, as that gets adopted, that I think we're going to do better at showing people that statement is wrong.
So how do you – well, for one thing, you probably eliminate the pants on fire category.
Well, actually, I think, you know, the wonderful thing about pants on fire, it does lighten up fact checking. And I think one of the things that I tried to do with PolitiFact and that I'm going to try to do with my work at Duke is to make journalism accessible. Mm. I think there's often been this kind of eat your vegetables journalism that we would go out and we would write long stories and expect that people would read them. And the reality is that I think people want substantive information, but I think they want it presented in an engaging way. And so I think the Truth-O-Meter and Pants on Fire managed to do that. PolitiFact is backed by tremendous solid research. but it's presented in an engaging way that I think brings a much broader audience to fact-checking.
Now, you talked about this research that suggests ways in which it can be presented so that as a kind of a correction rather than an injunction or an indictment. What are some of those ways?
Well, one of the things they've found is that when you put the fact-check beside a fact-check can reinforce a false statement if you don't tell people at the point of the false statement that it's false. So if you just put the statement and then make people maybe click to a different page to get to the rating, you can often reinforce the statement. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to get someone who watches Fox or someone who watches MSNBC to immediately change their mind on things. But by presenting them in better ways, Brendan has found that we can begin to chip away at some of these hard partisan beliefs.
On the State of Things today, I'm talking with Bill Adair, the creator of PolitiFact, and he is now a professor of computational journalism at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Just ahead, how Woodward and Bernstein inspired a generation of reporters, including Bill Adair. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, today talking to Bill Adair, creator of the fact-checking organization PolitiFact and a professor of computational journalism at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. So before the break, you're talking about being an umpire trying to be, right down the middle and objective in calling them how you see them without the commentary. But look, I mean, do you ever have an instinct to do a make good, which we sometimes see in the world of referees?
Right. I'm a hockey fan. So, yeah, the old makeup call.
Yeah.
No, you really have to resist that. And you really have to look at it as you're looking at this set of facts. You're looking at this statement and giving it an independent rating. And so one of the things that we have had lots of debates about is, should we keep score? Should we keep score of how many falses Republicans get and how many falses Democrats get? And I have always argued against that because I don't want to know. I don't want to ever feel any pressure. We gave the Democrats a false last time. So we don't. Now, we have in the back of our mind, we know what we've done because we can look at the website and we remember what the ratings are that we've given. But I still think it's best not to kind of keep that that greater score. Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing we do, and this has been, I think, helpful to our readers, is keep track by person. So you can go to the site and you can see for any member of Congress that we've checked or presidential candidates or now pundits, now that we've started Pundit Fact, you can see what their record is. And I think there's value to that. But that sort of greater party thing, I have resisted.
So you've been in this business for a while, I suppose, since you were a paper boy. Huh? I mean, you got started at an early age.
I did. I was a paper boy back when there was such a thing.
Yeah, we called them paper boys then.
And it was a great job. I made some good money and got some exercise. I delivered the Arizona Republic, the daily paper in Phoenix. And had a great time, and it gave me an early exposure to journalism and made me really love this business. Seeing the news first, unsnapping the bundles of papers and sticking them in my bike is just a very vivid memory for me. And it really helped start a real love of journalism.
And your mom played an important part.
My mom had been the secretary to the managing editor of the Saturday Evening Post in Philadelphia. And when I was 12, she said to me, you should go into journalism. You'll make a great reporter. And so I did, because you should always do what your mom says.
most of the time, that's true. What were you doing that suggested to anybody that you'd be a good reporter? Were you writing?
I don't know. I mean, I had always enjoyed writing, but I was always curious. I was one of these kids who I used to love taking apart transistor radios to see if I could figure out how they worked. I never could, and then I could never get them back together. But I was very curious as a child, and my mother very much encouraged that, fostered that, and would do things that would indulge my curiosity. And so, and I have found now, after doing this for 30 years as a journalist, that being a reporter is really having a license to be curious. You can look into anything. You can ask anybody anything. And I've always felt like it is the mission of the journalist to tell people how the world works. And so whether it's PolitiFact or the way I covered politics before, or aviation safety before that, I've always seen my role as to explain to people how the world works.
And then there was this film that probably played some kind of role. Let's hear it.
You let Haldeman slip away.
Yes.
You've done worse than let Haldeman slip away, get people feeling sorry for him. I didn't think that was possible. In a conspiracy like this, you build from the outer edges and you go step by step. If you shoot too high and miss, everybody feels more secure. You put the investigation back months.
Yes, we know that. And if we're wrong, we're resigning. Were we wrong?
You'll have to find that out, won't you?
Listen, I'm tired of your games. I don't want hints. I need to know what you know.
There we go. Well, there was the Hollywood version of All the President's Men, based on an episode in American history we now call Watergate. Pretty important for people who came of age in those days.
And incredibly inspiring to me. That movie came out when I was about 12, and it was it was just a great movie, and I've probably seen it 100 times. It's so good, and in fact, I could even tell in that excerpt there was a word edited out. So it's just a great, great movie, and it was a movie that said journalists can make a difference, and also that journalists can be incredibly good looking. And so I figured that if I went into journalism, that I could be as good looking as Robert Redford or Dustin Hoffman.
How did any of that work out for you?
Well, you can see not so
well.
Yeah,
no, the good-looking part, you got that nailed. But let me ask you this, though, but how has it panned out for you in terms of the expectations that film, and to a certain extent, I mean, that was a golden age of journalism, would you say?
Well, it was, and of course, we had no idea then about the digital age and what it would do to journalism. But I think for me personally, journalism has been a marvelous career, and I love now that I'm teaching to try to pass that on to my students, to show them how wonderful this career can be, that it's very rewarding in terms of just your ability, as I was saying earlier, to indulge your curiosity, but also to make a difference. And I'm really proud when I look back over my work, not just in creating PolitiFact, but in doing investigative reporting, in doing lots of different kinds of stories, that a few of them at least have had an impact in the world in one way or another. And that's really rewarding. And I think the glamour of Watergate paid off for me. I mean, I think I have loved this business as much as I dreamed I would when I saw that movie.
The industry was held in higher regard then, and there was a sense that journalism had a greater impact on public policy. I mean, do you think that has changed, the level of impact that journalism has?
Well, it's changed. I think it's different. I don't know that it's worse. Could reporters come along and have as important a story as Watergate? Absolutely. And you look at the kind of reporting that's being done today by Bart Gellman at The Washington Post into the NSA and the wiretapping that the government's been doing and all of the many revelations that we've seen. That is important journalism. And that's the kind of thing that I think, looking back when All the President's Men came out, that I might have dreamed of being part of. It's different, though. You look at the nature of there are so many different outlets now. It's not just The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Associated Press, the three networks. And I think that's fine. I think now, and one of the things we talk about a lot in my classes is the need to be an informed consumer. and the need to understand different kinds of journalism and to be skeptical about what you hear and read. But I think journalists today can have as big an impact as Woodward and Bernstein did in 1974.
When we think about the biggest stories, when we think about Abu Ghraib, when we think about Watergate, or as you say, the NSA, all of those hinged on an insider coming forward with information that they had. And thankfully, we had a free press, you know, into which they could feed that information so that the public can be. But there's another kind of journalism, and I want to talk with you more about computational journalism, because we're seeing more and more computer-assisted research where people are mining databases and putting two and two together so you can report a story without an insider that shows that the toxic waste dumps and the other kinds of dangerous materials and places are also the places where the poor people live, and start to actually do a different kind of journalism that doesn't take a snitch or a deep throat in order for you to turn up some pretty important information, right?
Absolutely. And I think data is now a new tool and a great tool that journalists have to find things. I saw a great chart over the weekend that told the story of the dysfunction of Congress through this amazing graphic that looked like a molecule kind of splitting into two, a red one and a blue one. They had been merged back in the 80s, and as the votes went on, the red and blue, the votes of members of Congress have split apart. And so that sort of graphic was just very revealing about what's happened in our Congress. And that would not have been possible in 1976. And now what's wonderful about the digital tools is that they are not just the turf of the biggest news organizations. You can take, you know, anybody with a PC and a little bit of creativity can take a database and find something that's not just revealing, but that's important, and create some great journalism.
Now, the question is, have we lost our appetite for that? And has digital media also distracted us and fragmented our attention so that we can now silo ourselves, look for the side that we're interested in, and only mine the information? As you say, I want conservative fact checkers.
I worry about that. I really think that it's easier than ever to live in an echo chamber and to surround yourself with people who remind you why you're right. And it makes you feel good. You know, if you watch the cable network that you believe in, and you watch the host you like, and it's like, yeah, I'm right. And one of the things that newspapers, I think, do really well is they give you a sampling of opinion on an op-ed page. And it's in front of you, and you can entertain the possibility that your side may not be right. And I do worry that it's easier than ever to live in an echo chamber.
So one of the criticisms of President Obama has been that he did what you described, which is not talk through the press, but go directly using social media out to an audience. It tends to be a self-selecting audience. But interestingly enough, I mean, that was the same criticism of Ronald Reagan, right?
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think there was an article in Politico last spring, and it talked about it was called Obama the Puppet Master. And it talked about how, you know, isn't it amazing all these things that Obama's doing to go directly to the people? He's going around the press. He hasn't done an interview with Politico in a long time. And I read it and just laughed, because, you know, not only Reagan, I mean, you can go back to decades. I mean, presidents have been trying to go around the media forever. And so this is not a new phenomenon. Now, what's new are the ways that Obama can do it. And it happens that this White House and the Obama organization is particularly savvy about social media and digital tools. And so they're incredibly effective at that. But the idea of going around the filter, as Anita Dunn, Obama's communications director, said to my presidency class, that idea has been around since at least Franklin Roosevelt with the fireside chats.
But Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson are two examples, I think, of another kind of quality that may have changed. They did have direct contact with those reporters. There was a press corps. They got to know them, hung out with them, drank with them. And now we're not seeing so much of that anymore. And it's not Barack Obama who's doing the tweeting, Right. I mean, he has an organization. So what's the difference in the candidates when parties needed a guy back then who could actually chum around with the press and make contact with them? Now you don't need that guy anymore.
Well, it's an interesting point. I think with video cameras so small and portable and the ability to get high quality footage out of any event now, the networks would send these embedded reporters on the campaign trail to the point where there was really no moment in the 2012 campaign or really even in the 2008 campaign that was off the record. And I remember covering the New Hampshire primary and the Iowa caucus in 2004 and having lots of off the record moments with presidential candidates. And I think that's really important for you to get to know them. And that's gone. And so I think if you ask Romney, who, you know, faced a big factor in the campaign, an iPhone, surreptitious iPhone recording of a speech he made to a group of donors, you know, Romney would say there is no such thing as off the record anymore. So I understand why the politicians have cut off access, because I think they're frustrated that they just can't ever let their guards down. And if you go back to reporters who covered the White House in the Johnson days, they'll tell you these incredible stories. I remember sitting with Bob Schieffer from CBS talking about his conversations with Lyndon Johnson. And it was a very different kind of relationship, you know. And he would see Johnson often and really got to know him. But much of that was off the record. And now everything's on the record. And there are definitely some – and it must seem funny to hear this from a journalist. But I don't think it's a good thing when everything's on the record.
Well, it gives you a chance. I mean, it's a double-edged sword, right? I mean, on the one hand, you get to know who the candidate is, who the office holder is. You can understand their tendencies. You can cut through. I mean, you can hear a lie. You know when it's a lie, so you can go fact-check yourself. You say, I don't know. I'm going to go check them. On the other hand, you get to be a friend, and it gets to be hard to kind of turn states on them when the time is right, right?
Yeah, and that's always – I mean – covering anything. I wrote a book about a plane crash investigation. I got to know the investigators really well. So you try to resist the urge to cut them breaks because you know them and you like them. But inevitably, there are going to be those kinds of conflicts. I think with presidents, though, it's disappointing that their reaction is to just cut off access, because I think everyone benefits when we see more of these people. But, you know, if they can – they make the calculation, we need to reach this particular group, so we're going to make ourselves available to so-and-so, but we don't need to talk to Politico or whoever.
And control the message. And one of the things that we can never lose sight of is that this is – I mean, you call it a full contact sport. It is a very dangerous game. And I know the death of a journalist who is a friend of yours also had an important impact on your decisions. Was there not a local journalist who
– Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Was not actually a friend of mine. When I was in – when I was growing up in Phoenix, there was a investigative reporter, Don Bowles, and he was going to meet a source, and when he had the meeting, when he came out, started his car, the car blew up. This is when I was in eighth grade, so I was delivering the paper. I didn't know him, and he died a couple weeks later. And it was again a moment, I think it was roughly the same time the movie came out, of All the President's Men, that it was just another moment that said to me, journalism can really make a difference.
What was he reporting on?
He was an investigative reporter looking into the mob in Arizona, and very powerful exhibit at the museum is actually the car that he was in, and you can see the hole in the bottom of the car where he was, and the windshield is shattered. And you look at it and you realize the stakes of journalism can be really big and that what the work we do is really important.
Bill Adair is my guest, creator of PolitiFact and a professor of computational journalism at Duke at the university's Sanford School of Public Policy. And our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, and I'm talking with Bill Adair. He's a creator of PolitiFact. He's a professor at Duke Sanford School now, teaches computational journalism. Tell us what you're doing now. What are you telling those kids?
Well, we've been talking a lot about how presidents communicate and what are the most effective messages. We spent a lot of time this fall on talking points and dissecting what makes a good talking point and why some don't work.
Well, you know, that's one of the things when you talk about how you ruffle feathers when you do your job. You know, when we've resisted talking to politicians for a long time because who wants to hear them on their talking points when you ask them a question about, you know, policy A and they go to policy B? And then if you badger them, if you say, but that's not – that's when the complaints come in saying, aha, you see you're a leftist because you asked this – you pointed out the fact that embarrassed the governor or whatever. Anyway, I say, well, that's my job, right? So that's part of the problem. How do they take to that? I mean, so how do you kind of cope with that problem?
Well, I think as a journalist, our job is to try to get as close to the ultimate truth as we can. That's a pretty lofty goal. But I think the key is to you can't worry too much about the blowback that you get. And we've taken it at PolitiFact from both sides for a long time to the point where we have pretty thick skin and we don't let it get to us. And I think the reality is that some politicians are better than others at communicating. And sometimes they can communicate in ways where they get their facts right. And other times they communicate in ways where they can really twist and distort things as they tell stories. And one of the things that we talked about a lot in my presidency class this fall is Obamacare and how Obamacare, if you just look at the facts, it's one thing. But so much about Obamacare has been twisted by the opponents of the law. And so it really has kept an army of fact checkers busy for the past 3 years to try to get to the bottom of these claims that often are exaggerated or false.
Well, let's get a little lofty here. I mean, here's the thing about us humans. We trade in symbols, and some of those symbols are words, and sometimes those words can add up to a fact. But the idea that we've actually captured the truth or the reality of a thing is a little far-fetched for our furry little pea brains. So this brings us to kind of what is a fact, and we're really motivated by stories, by these larger pictures and context. And when you mince any large context that's complicated into a series of facts, you're going to miss a lot. And that I think, is some of the frustration on the part of the left and the right over whose facts you're going to accept because they don't add up to my story, right?
Well, and what we've tried to do at PolitiFact is by boiling down to the most basic claim what the factual claim is. And I think one flaw of some of the early fact-checking was it looked too broadly at something. And by reducing it to what we call the ruling statement, which is the sentence that we're fact-checking, I think we can be more precise about that. And then we can say, well, that statement is half true on our truth-o-meter or mostly false or whatever. But, you know, you get at something that we can't ignore that some politicians are particularly good communicators. And because they know how to tell stories, they know how to paint these pictures. You know, Ronald Reagan was a master. Barack Obama in the 2008 campaign was a master communicator, although lately it doesn't seem like he has had the platform to do that. But you need to, as journalists, we need to cut through that and say, but what is he really saying? And is it accurate?
But see, that's where it becomes subjective. I mean, at that point, you've left the fact, and now you're saying, here's what it adds up to. And that's when it's a little bit – I mean, you think about Ronald Reagan, the invasion of Grenada, right, to save the medical students. Well, that was a lie. Those students were not in trouble. It was a flat lie, and it happened a week after the president was responsible for the deaths of 256 Marines on the tarmac in Lebanon for an ill-advised and never properly explained policy about ending a civil war in Lebanon. President was embarrassed. He went in with another military, and that was the story. It's pretty clear that's what happened, and America's never held him accountable for that.
Well, and as a journalist, I can't get America to hold somebody. It's up to America whether to hold someone accountable. But as a journalist, I hope I can give them the tools to make those decisions. And I think the mistake that too many journalists made in the last 15 years is that we were afraid of calling the balls and strikes, and we were afraid somebody would call us biased if we said something was false. And so I'm really happy to see this movement taking root of fact-checking. And there are new sites popping up. There's one in New York, and there's the sites around the world. It's very encouraging to see more of this. So I think this is actually a promising new era in accountability journalism.
Now, you remember the moment in the 2012 election, Candy Crowley was the moderator, and she did a spot fact check during a debate between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney.
I want to make sure we get that for the record, because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror.
Get the transcript.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of terror.
Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
He did call it an act of terror. It did as well take... It did as well take 2 weeks or so for the whole idea of there being a riot out there about this tape to come out. You're correct about that.
The administration...
Right, and then she got a lot of flack for that, right?
Well, you know, it's funny. She and I talked about that. I thought... given the confines of trying to be a moderator, you know, you don't want to like stop the debate every moment and say, you know, what you just said, that was mostly false. Mike Barnicle once said to me that what we should do during a debate is that when somebody makes a false statement, that I should go on stage and slap them across the face. We can't really do that.
You could have like big clown shoes and a nose. You could be the jester and get away. Yeah.
I think what I loved about that was that it was another example of the press holding someone accountable for what they said. And now we've gone another step. PolitiFact just launched Pundit Fact, which is fact-checking pundits and talk show hosts and holding them accountable for what they say and putting their statements to the truth-o-meter. So I think this is, like I said, I think we're early in the accountability journalism movement or in the fact-checking movement, but it's very promising, and is it rough and tumble? You bet. You know, this is journalism that makes people mad, but that's okay, and that's part of what we sign on to, because it's so important that what we're trying to do is inform democracy.
How are students feeling about this? I've seen some rather disturbing statistics about more students in journalism programs involved in public relations than journalism. There doesn't seem to be an appetite for it. What are you seeing on campus?
Well, because I think there's an appetite for a paycheck. With so many news organizations shrinking, it's not a particularly promising field in the immediate term. But still, there are a lot of really talented students who are choosing to go into journalism, and I encourage them strongly, because I really do believe we're at a moment of rebirth of journalism, and that the old models, newspaper printed and thrown on your driveway every morning, are gonna fade away. But as we were talking about earlier, there are more news organizations than ever. And so there are plenty of opportunities to do great reporting and great writing. And so I think I have one student who's taking a job in journalism and thrilled about it. And I'm glad to see that there are still students who realize the promise of this and want to do it.
I wonder if there isn't some restructuring in the marketplace itself. I mean, if you think about, I know you said it's not the job of the journalist to get, you know, people to get the result. But if people were actually talking about news in common, right, wouldn't that increase an appetite for a more generalized form of reporting rather than this siloed kind of I'm seeking out validation rather than information? And that would mean that if you're an enterprising journalist, you might even create common spaces where people come together. And now, as it turns out, I might just need some information for this fun event to take place. I mean, do we need to be more creative about the consumer side, the demand side as well?
Absolutely. And I think – and we need to think about different forms, not just on the web but on mobile. And we need to think about different forms – not if you think about what you read on a blog is often the same form of journalism that's been used for 100 years. And so I think we need to do more inventing of new forms like Homicide Watch, which is a very creative approach that they use in Washington, D.C. Laura Amico, a journalist there, started to track every homicide. And it's a fascinating way to tell a lot of different things about the District of Columbia. So I think it's a time when we can invent new things like that. And I'm really very hopeful about the promise of journalism. Now, we have to figure out the business model, and that's not easy. And a lot of places are trying, and you know, so far a few have done well, you know, Huffington Post and BuzzFeed and some others. And I'm hopeful there'll be plenty more of those.
You're looking into the influence of smartphones, mobile. What are you finding?
Well, it's I think we need to even think beyond smartphones. One thing we're experimenting with at Duke is an app that puts headlines on your wristwatch, and this is not where you're going to have a lengthy discussion of issues, but it's a place where you can get information. And there are new watches that can display text in addition to the time. And so a student who's working with me, Aaron Krulik, has created an app that will move headlines onto your Pebble wristwatch. I think we need to do things like try different kinds of story forms for covering the North Carolina legislature and keeping track of bills and keeping track of what's going on. And so one of the things I'd like to do in the next couple of years is experiment in that area.
You know, one of the disturbing trends I've seen, there was an Elon poll out recently that showed how few North Carolinians knew what information they had a right to know. And we're finding more and more public agencies saying, well, that's, you know, what we paid this individual isn't any of your business. And why we hired this individual isn't public record. Police departments who have, you know, deaths on public property who fail to release reports. And there's no, I don't know that the public understands that this is our information, not theirs.
Well, yeah, I think we need to do a couple of things there. One, when we get a good and important story because of public records, I think we need to point that out, and we need to say this story was made possible because of a robust public records law. I also think we need to fight any time that a local government or the state government makes information, you know, tries to keep information secret. I think we need to really push back against that. And, you know, we're finding a friend at UNC who's doing some research has found that local governments will put some information on their websites, but often not everything. And so you'll look at a website and you'll think, oh, well, here are the whatever, you know, the restaurant inspections or the police reports or whatever. Well, they are the ones that the government wants you to see often, not necessarily every report. And so I think that needs to be a real effort by the news media and by public interest groups to really push back because, you know, as we say in the data world, you know, data just wants to be free.
What do you think is the reputation of journalists and journalism these days, and how do you think it's changed from the days of Woodward and Bernstein?
Well, you know, the joke always is that it's that journalists rank near the bottom. I think it varies. You know, I think in a lot of cases, journalists don't do a great job telling their own stories, and celebrating the work that they do. And so I think the public doesn't realize it. And at a time when the legacy news organizations don't have the resources to advertise, to do much marketing, it's hard to sort of celebrate the great work that's being done. I think journalists are always going to ruffle feathers. And I think that's, there's the old saying, the duty of the journalist to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And I think that you don't get into this business to make friends. You get into this business to do important work. And it's incredibly rewarding. It's just being done much differently these days.
What are your students in it for? What are they, why do they tell you they're interested?
Well, I think they realize it's an important part of a democracy, that they need to I think they do feel the need to inform, tell the world, tell people how things work. I think many of them also just see it as an interesting career. In one class, I have a lot of sports writers who work for the Duke Chronicle and do a great job at covering Duke athletics. And I'm not sure there are a lot of lofty reasons in what they do, other than I think they think it's a really rewarding job.
Bill, what a pleasure. Keep up the good work, and great to meet you. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Bill Adair, creator of PolitiFact and now a professor of computational journalism at Duke's Sanford School of Public Policy. For more information, you go to our website, stateofthings.org. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening. If you have a comment, you can go to that website as well. We also have information about other programs, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolfe, the news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.